Today is Friday, September the 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. The Pentagon's chief says that Al-Qaeda may seek a comeback in Afghanistan now that U.S. forces have left and the Taliban are again in power.
They will always attempt to find space to grow and regenerate, whether it's there, whether it's in Somalia.
On Saturday, the United States marks the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, the largest terrorist attacks in American history. On that day, millions watched as first responders worked tirelessly at what came to be known as Ground Zero. So what was it like for the first responders?
It was a very horrific, frightening, confusing time. People had really not a clear idea about what was going on.
And more political fallout in the Gambia after the ruling party of President Adama Barrow formed an unlikely alliance with the party of former dictator Yahya Jammeh ahead of December elections. We'll have those stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. And for our top story, the Pentagon chief says that Al-Qaeda may seek a comeback in Afghanistan now that the U.S. forces have left and the Taliban are again in power. AP Washington correspondent Saga Megani reports.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin says that's just the nature of Al-Qaeda and others like the Islamic State group.
They will always attempt to find space to grow and regenerate, whether it's there, whether it's in Somalia, whether it's in any other ungoverned space.
Speaking to reporters as he ended a Persian Gulf states tour, Austin says the U.S. is ready to prevent an Al-Qaeda comeback and has warned the Taliban not to again give the militants sanctuary like they did before 9/11. Sagar Megani, Washington.
And President Joe Biden has signed an executive order requiring all government employees to be vaccinated against COVID-19. The rules also affect large employers and healthcare staff. The new vaccine rules are geared towards containing the latest surge of COVID-19 and could apply to as many as 100 million Americans.
As your president, I'm announcing tonight a new plan to require more Americans to be vaccinated to combat those blocking public health. My plan also increases testing, protects our economy, and will make our kids safer in schools. It consists of 6 broad areas of action. But if we implement them, I believe, and the scientists indicate, that the months ahead we can reduce the number of unvaccinated Americans, decrease hospitalizations and deaths, and allow our children to go to school safely and keep our economy strong by keeping businesses open. First, we must increase vaccinations among the unvaccinated with new vaccination requirements.
That was President Joe Biden speaking at the White House. You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. On Saturday, the United States marks the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks on the country. Longtime journalist Adam Phillips was part of the team of VOA reporters, editors, and engineers covering the attacks and their aftermath. He was on the ground both here in Washington and then in New York City, his hometown. And today we bring you the second part of his conversation with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson about his work in those days. They start this part of their discussion by talking about how Phillips coped with the devastation of a city that he loves.
Well, it was interesting because, you know, and I think I mentioned this phrase to you before, because I had a kind of a double role. I was a participant, as you say. I was a New Yorker. I mean, I'm not made of stone, and I had an incredible amount of feelings about all this, and very poignant and sometimes very difficult feelings. And at the same time, I had to be an observer. So in a kind of a sneaky way, and this is one of the drawbacks of the kind of journalism that I do, I had to distance myself a little bit in order to ask the question to get the sound bites that I needed to tell the story. So it gave me a little bit of distance. If I didn't have any role in this, then it would have been much more difficult because it would have just been this gaping maw of questions and anger and grief and all that. But I was able to process it through conversations with people who were themselves processing it in the first person. And so that gave me a little bit of safety and protection. One thing that's interesting, that was really, really novel and new for me in my perception was that you know, New York is a huge city, very, very, very diverse and busy and lots of money and different groups, et cetera. But I'd always seen it more as like a machine. I'd never seen it really as a living thing. I felt like the city itself was like really hurt. And I'd never thought of a city as its own being in a way that could be hurt, that could be vulnerable, that could be wounded. And so that was a real shift for me to realize that I love this place. And in a way, the place, you know, had its own personality, agency, history, and heart. And that was a real opening for me. And I never lost that, you know, I never lost that again.
Now, you mentioned earlier the issue of the toxic debris. Now, scientists have discovered, doctors have discovered that toxic debris, it actually proved to be quite dangerous to many of the people who were down near ground zero for prolonged periods. You yourself were one of the victims of that. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened to you and what you know of what's happened to others?
Yeah, well, I mean, for one thing, I was near ground zero a lot, just reporting, like those people I told you about who were taking all this, the material and the debris from ground zero proper, right? So that was already exposing me to a lot. But the VOA Bureau, you know, the offices of VOA, when I would go back, didn't exactly overlook ground zero, but it was, you know, maybe a kilometer, like half a kilometer away or something. I mean, we could see it clearly from the windows. And so we were breathing the air all that time. My engineer, Preston, he got terrible cancer from that. I think it was kidney cancer or something. I forgot now. Somebody else had developed terrible chronic asthma. But these can sometimes take quite a while to surface and push through a thing called the Victims Compensation Fund to pay people or their survivors, you know, to compensate them financially for some of the stuff that happened to them. And indeed, in 2017, I developed lung cancer, and then I just got prostate cancer last year.
Now, I want to talk a little bit. You were talking about New York as a living organism almost. Has it recovered? Has its heart recovered?
The first was the economic recovery. I mean, there was so many, all the downtown was so devastated. It was like small businesses, everything was shuttered, et cetera, not to mention the health risks. And I think that slowly it did. It sort of like, remember those old movies of the train starting and that wheel would turn and then start turning faster and faster and faster until it was chugging along? I think until COVID, it really had. But then COVID hit, which was similar in some ways because all of a sudden the city, at least in the early days of 9/11, was dead. It was like there was no traffic, just emergency vehicles, and Times Square was shuttered. There were no lights on in a lot of the places. People were scared to go out, or they were just sort of huddled in doorways, et cetera. And all you hear was the sirens and sometimes a little bit of clacking, you know, clapping and banging on pans for all the health workers. But that was a trauma that we had not recovered from. We've really been set back by this COVID thing. I think we'll survive. We did before. But the recovery, sort of the spiritual recovery of the place was compromise, shall we say.
That was journalist Adam Phillips, who retired this year after 28 years of reporting around the world for VOA. He was speaking with my colleague, Kate Pound Dawson.
Voice of America!
Now, first responders are always on the front line, facing highly stressful and risky calls during a crisis like the one on September 11th, 2001. For the hundreds of first responders, after the attacks on the Twin Towers in New York, the trauma of having to witness the suffering of that day still lives with them. Many still experiencing post-traumatic stress symptoms, and others saying that the events of that day forever shaped both their personal and professional lives. Dr. Judy Kriansky is a clinical psychologist with the United Nations and an adjunct professor at the clinical psychology program at Columbia University. She was one of the first responders at what came to be known as Ground Zero. And Dr. Judy, as she is popularly known, recounts to me some of the
It was a very horrific, frightening, confusing time. People had really not a clear idea about what was going on. I am a psychologist and a mental health professional, and my assignment as a Red Cross volunteer was to walk the pit. They call it the perimeter of the pit, which is the hole where all the buildings fell and all the debris was. It also is called the pile. And so my assignment, very rare, there were very few psychologists like myself who were assigned to that assignment because it was extremely central and difficult. So what I was doing was walking around the perimeter of this hole with all the debris.
Right.
And all the debris was around.
Was that the day after the attacks?
It was a day. I was on the night shift, so it wasn't the day after, but the night after the day after.
Okay. And what kind of activity was taking place at that time? Were they still rescuing people? We're still digging.
Massive amount of digging for any survivors.
Right. And that your job was to come in and be around that perimeter so that whoever was coming in or was being rescued or even the first responders were having to witness these very traumatic scenes.
Totally. They weren't just witnessing, they were there. I mean, these were the firemen, the policemen, the FBI, the electricians, all the workers who were there. So I'm walking around the perimeter comforting people, and there's digging going on, massive, all the digging that you saw of trying to find the bodies and the screaming and the crying, come over here, you know, walk over here.
I imagine there was a lot of chaos going on.
Total chaos.
A lot of unknown.
Total chaos. And people desperation to find people. And that was still it was the very beginning. So it wasn't late after a period of time, there was the resolution, the horrible resolution that there were not going to be any bodies, any people alive found. This was at the time. They were still hoping there could be real people alive.
Mm.
So my job
was... How long were you at the scene? How long were you there?
Months, like almost 3 months. Mm. And then I was assigned to the Family Assistance Center because once it was decided that there were no people there, the shift was to help the families.
What kind of psychosocial support do the survivors need, or even the families?
It was grieving, total grieving. I mean, there was massive, massive grieving and desperation and all the stages of grief and loss were present in terms of, you know, disbelief was part of it.
20 years later, when you look back, when you remember each year we commemorate this day, what does this day mean for you?
It means really tremendous sadness. There's nothing but horror and sadness about what happened and why it happened. And, I mean, this has been said over and over again.
Let me ask you about this new poll that just came out. You talked about the beginning. A new poll shows that Americans increasingly say that the events of that day, September 11th, 2001, had a more negative than positive impact on the country, that there was an America before 9/11 and after 9/11. What's your take on that?
Oh, there's no question. I mean, the 9/11 shifted. We call it a marker event. A marker event means that people are never, ever the same. And it's still referred to. There are those of us who certainly went through it. There's a new generation who weren't even born, but they're learning about it because they see it on TV and they hear about it from their friends and their parents. So it will never, ever go away. Mm-hmm. And as much as we try to rewrite history in so many different ways now because of what's happening on the racial front, there's no rewriting history about what happened then. I don't think anybody's trying to refute the facts about what happened.
And how did this shape your career, your professional career?
Well, that's a very good question. It shifted my career tremendously because subsequent to that, I spent years until now. I'm a first responder to all kinds of events that are drastic. So I'm a first responder doing psychosocial support after the earthquake in Haiti, and then after the tsunami earthquake in Japan, and after that, the earthquake in Yushu in China. So it changed me tremendously in being dedicated to being a first responder in many, many disasters after that.
That was Dr. Judy Kuriansky, a clinical psychologist with the United Nations and an adjunct professor at the clinical psychology program at Columbia University. I reached her at her home in New York City. Media reports say that the Taliban will now allow about 200 foreigners, including Americans, to fly out of Kabul. This will mark the airport's first flight since U.S. forces withdrew from the country. The group are to depart on a Qatar Airways flight that had earlier ferried humanitarian aid to the country. In North Macedonia, an explosion sparked by a fire killed 14 people at a COVID-19 hospital. Local media broadcast images of a huge blaze at the hospital in the town of Tetovo as firefighters raced to the scene. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. In the middle of last month, the American University of Beirut Medical Center issued a statement raising an alarm that patients' lives were at risk because of the lack of fuel to power electricity in the hospital. Lebanon, which is undergoing an economic meltdown, the worst in over 150 years, lacks the funds to import fuel to its power plants. Reporter George Eid has more for VOA from Beirut.
Almost 2 weeks ago, the American University of Beirut Medical Center, one of the most prominent hospitals in Lebanon and the Middle East, had issued a distress call stating that at least 40 adults and 15 children on ventilators and other life-saving medical devices were in imminent threat of death because fuel was running out in the hospital. This comes at a time when Lebanon was and is still fighting fuel shortages due to a major economic crisis that started in the country in 2019. The hospital managed to get fuel that allowed it to continue functioning and to rescue the lives of its patients. However, today, the same disaster might repeat itself again because fuel shortages are crippling the whole country, says the AUB Medical Center Director Joseph Otaik, who spoke to VOA from Beirut.
The risk that the patients were of dying because of lack of energy for the respirators, there was a meeting between the Ministry of Oil and the Central Bank, and they decided to refrain from completely stopping the subsidy of the fuel oil. That enables the fuel companies to sell fuel to AUB the same day. And we're able to generating electricity and to avoid any death or any major problem for the patients in the hospital.
Country, even treating everyday patients that are in need of regular checkups and minor surgeries, has become very hard as medical supplies are scarce. Lebanese medical doctor Salah Zainuddin explains the situation to VOA.
We have a lot of shortage of medicine, of supplies. Have patients who cannot get their inhaler, cannot get their medications. Even the generic ones are not available. They have to resort to friends and relatives outside Lebanon to try to ship for them and then carry them with their suitcases some medicines. Some essentials are not available, including chemotherapy, including life-sustaining medications that we give for very serious illnesses such as lung fibrosis or pulmonary hypertension, for example. In addition, we have shortage of equipment. Like if we want to do special bronchoscopies and special procedures which require equipment, the catheters are not available anymore. So that is putting a huge impact on the quality of care that we can provide. even for the regular basic care, such as providing oxygen supplies for patients when they need oxygen at home, this is not available. And if they can have the machines, they are not able to provide the power to operate them 24/7 as it should be. So they have lots of interruptions for this vital treatment. Some patients had to come in the hospital to ensure that they can get the oxygen they need, which should be provided at home in a simple way, but unfortunately is not in some scenarios. It's a dire condition, and the situation is getting tougher by the day, as I said.
The crisis is expected to get worse, according to Lebanese media reports, because Lebanon lacks the necessary funds to import fuel. The country risks a total electric blackout, and harsh days are expected to be ahead. Reporting from Beirut, George Aid, VOA.
And let's go to West Africa, in the Gambia, where a high-ranking government official of the Gambian government has resigned, saying that her principles wouldn't allow her to continue to work with President Adama Barrow's government after the political merger between Barrow's NPP party and former dictator Yahya Jammeh's APRC party. Fatou Joe Mané was President Barrow's advisor on strategic communication development. She said that the merger with Jammeh's party had many implications for governance and integrity. Reporter Panderimbai has been following the story. He reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Fatou Joe Mané was President Barrow's honorary advisor on strategic communication, development, and emerging social issues. She has resigned from the government while arguing that her principles wouldn't allow her to work with a government that has formed an alliance with the APRC party, a former regime she said has violated the rights of Gambians.
It's a very difficult decision because I really, really intend to stand by Barrow and usher in the new democracy that you and I fought for this past 22 years. But unfortunately, this MOU that's been signed and this alliance with the APRC has really, really shattered all that I stood for.
Mané's resignation came as a surprise to the Barrow government. She knows that the APRC-NPP merger is an affront to Gambia's Never Again slogan that was meant to end impunity in the country.
The country is still not even healed yet. We're not recovered yet. So to bring back that same apparatus, to bring back that same leadership, to align with those or to ally with those back into the Gambia at this time, I think it's a bit premature and we're not prepared for it and I'm a bit shaken by it and it has really, really shaken my trust in the government, so I just decided to let go.
It was this past week that the APRC leadership announced that it has formed an alliance with Barrow's NPP. The party says the merger would help facilitate Barrow's re-election into office.
We are not even stable yet, so bringing back that chaos and that terror, that's terrifying people. That's a big disappointment for us, for all of us, whether you are in a struggle or outside of it, or you're a Gambian or whatever. We don't want back that terror.
Under the political merger arrangements between the two parties, part of the APRC demands include the return of their leader Yahya Jammeh into the country. They also are going to be part of Barrow's government if Barrow is re-elected.
Who is the APRC to decide this is what we want from you? This, yeah, we are coming. This is what you need to give us. This is what you have to do for us. No, it's a legitimate party. And believe me, 80% of APRC, it's like they're all innocent. It's like any other party in the country. They have all right to vote for Barrow if they want, but they just cannot put him on the spot to make him sign an MOU before they support him. You know, they are not in control. Barrow is the president.
Sehu Mbalo is President Barrow's deputy youth advisor.
But it is very normal for somebody to tender his or her resignation from an appointment. So we don't see this thing as anything. It is her decision to resign, and we have no problem with that.
He says it is wrong for anyone to blame the APRC for the crimes that were committed during Jammeh's rule. For VOA News, this is Panderimbai reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
And still in the Gambia, the political fallout due to the merger of two major political parties, President Adama Barrow's party and that of former longtime ruler Yahya Jammeh continues to make news around the country. Some in the Gambia say that the merger could derail democratic reforms in a nation that just started on a path to rebuild its democratic systems after over 20 years under the dictatorship of Yahya Jammeh. Seni Marena is the founding editor of Alkamba Times, a digital news platform covering Gambian news and politics. He joins me via phone to talk about the implications that this surprising political merger and what President Barrow seeks to gain from this alliance.
What Barrow hoped to gain from the alliance with the APRC is to, you know, seek for re-election, how he's going to win the election, because coming with forming an alliance with the APRC, a party which still have some base, will, you know, help him to get re-elected in the office. So basically, his intention of the alliance is to get re-elected to next five term in office again.
And how are Gambians generally reacting to this move? How is it shaping debate in the country as they prepare for the first elections post-Jammeh?
Yeah, since the announcement was made in the weekend, you know, there has been angry reactions from ordinary peoples in the streets of Banjul. You know, even in the rural Gambia, the discussions have been, why is President Barrow's NPP joining forces with a party that refused him to be sworn in the Gambia when Jammeh refused to step down? Why is President Barrow's party forming an alliance with a party that tormented Gambians, you know, for 22 years? And now Gambians are seeking justice. They are seeking reform of the institutions that were damaged. Why is the president, instead of focusing on building the transitional justice institution that include bringing Jammeh to justice, will now, you know, turn around to form an alliance with someone he is trying to prosecute or he's trying to investigate?
And what is the likelihood that Jammeh could return to the country after or before these elections? Has he given any hints or publicly expressed intentions of returning to the Gambia?
Yes, Jammeh has always been expressing intention of returning to the Gambia. There were a couple of times when media report claimed that Jammeh will return to Gambia on so-so date. And this announcement were made by Jammeh's own party that Jammeh will be coming to the Gambia. This was almost three times when the party came openly saying they're going to the airport to welcome Jammeh, you know, to come. And the saddest part of the entire alliance, you know, according to the APRC, there was an MOU that was signed between the NPP, Barrow's party, and the former President Jammeh's APRC party. And the content of this MOU, there was a document that was being circulated online saying one of the conditions of the MOU is to ensure the safe return of former President Yahya Jammeh to the Gambia, and also giving the APRC at least five cabinet positions should President Barrow win the re-election, and also a vice president position. But the NPP came, you know, out, you know, saying that the content of that document that has been circulated is not true, but they refuse to, you know, release the content of the MOU. And people like me are still investigating. Yesterday, I spoke to a legal person in Banjul. He told me the circulated MOU is well drafted, and he believes this is even drafted by a legal person from the Justice Ministry. So they are just denying the content of it because Gambians are so angry with the, you know, content or the forming of an alliance with APRC, but now it has been circulating. And key among them is the return of Jammeh, and also to give back Jammeh's asset, you know, when he returned to the Gambia, and to give his party five ministerial positions, including the vice president role.
That was Sene Marena, the founding editor of Alkamba Times, a digital news platform covering Gambian news and politics. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great weekend.